design and fine tune it, or more of the design element. This one's more for the fine tuning. Just some initial clarifications. Our method of reasoning is going to be abductive. Remember, abductive reasoning is slightly, it's very similar to inductive reasoning. We take the data, we're looking at the universe, the physical laws, the constants, certain values, and we're going to hypothesize an explanation for how it is the case that we have these that fit the existence of life. Definition of life, though, using anything that consumes, uses energy, and reproduces itself, a simple biological concept. Even more so, intelligent life, agency, namely human beings. And this argument is completely compatible with Darwinism. This is the reason why I like this argument. It's encompassing any geological or biological development. A more modest way you can put this argument is that we're arguing for the fine-tuning of the building blocks needed for life. So either way, if the Darwinist wants to make his arguments, that's fine. This argument completely encompasses that. All right. Here's the argument that we're going to use. This is actually set up in a deductive form. This kind of helps you clarify some of the nuances and some other versions of the argument. But as we go through it, we'll progress in a more abductive sense. But these are the options for the data. The fine-tuning of all physical reality is either due to chance, necessity, or design, or fine-tuning. The fine-tuning is not due to chance or necessity, therefore fine-tuning is due to design. Now, design is a term that carries a lot of metaphysical import with it. It carries over some type of agency with it. Fine-tuning is a little bit more neutral. Design, you've got religious implications. But with fine-tuning, even a secular scientist will recognize that there are certain elements to the universe that are fine-tuned in the sense that the universe is balanced on a razor's edge for the existence of life. So that's what we mean by that. Fine-tuning is religiously neutral. It doesn't carry that much of a metaphysical import with it. Additionally, to have a strong argument, this is more of my preference, is for the argument to be negative and positive. For the argument to be negative, I need to demonstrate that the other options that we're looking at are untenable or they are more implausible than the design option. And to make a positive case is to suggest that there is good reason for believing design. And where we'll go with that is we know that mind is an origin of information. That's a positive case that we'll make looking onto it. Brief historical development. This is perhaps one of the oldest arguments for the existence of God. Now remember, from the beginning, you'll remember this from some of your quizzes, the argument isn't going to get us to God. What this argument is going to get us is to a fine tuner. We need a cumulative case argument to get to God. This argument will just tell us that there is an agent out there, and this agent is extremely intelligent. It says nothing about the power, says nothing about the moral quality of this agent. So, for all intents and purposes, this is arguing for a fine tuner and not necessarily God. Though, through this course, we're making a cumulative case for God. All right, Plato, he would look at the workings of the universe, and he would infer that the existence of a mind that orders and structures the universe. Same with Cicero. He would look at a sundial, and he kind of made the same inferences from the sign there. It was really revitalized with William Paley. He's the most famous proponent of design, or the teleological argument. He would look at a watch and say, well, look how it's, the gears are arranged in such a way that it has an end purpose of displaying the time. But we may touch back on that later, but that's just a little background. I'm going to skip over that. Major proponents. This is Robin Collins. Jay Richards is the California boy up top. Bill Dembski is in the bottom right. Bill Craig is up in the top right. Bruce Gordon, James Sinclair. Just some faces that you can put with them. These are some major proponents and leading philosophers of science. Dr. Becca is actually trying to get Robin Collins to be my reader for my thesis. So he'll be on my thesis committee, hopefully. He's up at Messiah. He's a philosopher of science. This is what we're talking about today is where I'm actually taking my graduate research, so it's particularly interest of mine. Major skeptics of fine-tuning. They'll say that the argument is fine-tuned, but it's not designed. They recognize that the universe is balanced on a razor's edge. Stephen Hawking in the top right, he recently wrote The Grand Design, which, by the way, in his book, he advocated that, I don't know what they were thinking of titling The Grand Design, but he kind of throws out God. There's no need for that. Given the theory of gravity, which, we don't need God. Okay. Vic Stenger, his recent work is on a book titled The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning. Max Tegmark, with the red tie there, he calls himself a precision cosmologist out of MIT. Richard Dawkins, I guess that's a given. We gotta put him up there. I don't know. And Lawrence Krauss, he's very intelligent, but a very adamant atheist. All right, brief note on this one. Again, we'll be looking at this in an abductive sense. William Wool, Dr. Beck actually spoke about science and religion last class a little bit. And I think it's really important. If I could beat a dead horse, this would be the horse. Science and religion are completely compatible. Both are our scientific understanding of nature is part of God's revelation to us. So when we are able to find scientific truths from something, then we should accept that as God's truth. All truth is God's truth. So we must not be enmities with science, or have enmity with science. Now, I forget which year it was, but 1800s, William Wool was the first one to restrict the word science to natural science. Whereas with Augustinian science, agency and metaphysical import was acceptable explanation, whereas a Johannine science, no agency, no metaphysical import was allowed. So it was pretty recent until science was restricted to only natural explanation. All right, this is, just to keep this in the back of your mind, I'm not going to stick hard to this, but let's look at some of these terms. This was a formula developed by Dembski. It's basically a probability that's so improbable it's impossible. Let's look at the number 10 to the 80th. This is the number representing the number of elementary particles, quarks, leptons, bosons in the universe. They're able to weigh the universe. Don't ask me how. It has to do a lot with non-Euclidean geometry and all this. But they weigh the universe and they come to the conclusion there are 10 to the 80th elementary particles. So you take that number and then you take 10 to the 43, which is measured in Hertz, which represents the alterations in the states of matter per second. It's either 10 to the 43 or 10 to the 45. It's typically represented as the Planck scale, the smallest unit measure of time that has any meaning in the physical sense. And 10 to the 25 is the number of seconds, given the Big Bang model, of how long the universe can maintain its integrity from the beginning to the end when it collapses back in on itself, or when it expands and reaches a maximum entropy and there's no life, there's nothing. And that's a pretty liberal number there. So if you take all these, you get 10 to the 148, that's the total number of state changes that all elementary particles in the universe can undergo this duration. So that's, with all reason and our understanding of the universe, that's the greatest probability that anything can reasonably have of significant meaning in this universe. And we'll be looking at some numbers that are incredibly larger than this. So just keep this in the back of your mind. All right, we're going to go through a few examples of what we mean by fine-tuning here. Brief history. Science has typically had its historical development in the context of religion, with Copernicus, with Newton, Galileo. They consider their scientific endeavors to be forms of worship of God, of discovering more about Him in the natural sense. And I'll get to that in a second. We got another slide. All right. Example, we'll do gravity. The fine-tuning of gravity. All right, so right here we've got a star nursery. This is the same type of gas that you find, or same type of dust that you'll find in your house that's in that picture there. Gravity in this picture is starting to condense, to coagulate, to form pressure. If, for example, if it was the strength of gravity was increased, then everything would, the universe itself would collapse back in on itself right after the Big Bang. Now, remember, I'm doing this in the context of a natural theology or a natural science. I'm not presupposing a specific interpretation of the Bible. You can take this material, you can take it to your creation studies class, and then you can get your young earth creationism out of it if you want to do that. But I'm just approaching this from the secular point of view on a science, taking that data without the Bible, independent of that, and seeing what we can make with those arguments. All right. Oh, back to that. There's stars and planets. Yeah, that's fine. All right, the electromagnetic force. If there were different atomic bonds, and thus we would have different atomic bonds, different structures. Also, electromagnetism. We all know the electromagnetic spectrum, with gamma rays being of the highest frequency and radio waves being the lowest. So if we were to increase these by any particular amount, when we go through these examples, keep in mind if I were to draw on this whiteboard up here, say electromagnetism, and then I would put a little dial next to it, and after all of this we were going to have a little machine making, or a universe generating machine. In the end, if we adjust any of the values of this whatsoever, life would not exist, or even the universe itself would be unstable and would collapse back in on itself or expand beyond all recognizability. And life could not exist. And it's not in the sense that if we also alter, say, the value of gravity and then try to counteract that with, say, the electromagnetic force, that still wouldn't work. All right, the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force, just a recap. Are there any physics majors in here? Somebody keep me accountable for my physics. Any biology majors? Okay. Chemistry, science in general, math. What are you guys doing here?
The Bible.
Okay. All right. All right. The strong nuclear force is the force that keeps the protons and the neutrons of the atomic nucleus together. Typically, you would think that those particles would repel each other, but it's that force that keeps the atoms together. So, I mean, you've heard some numbers like atoms are 90% space or something. I'm not quite sure how exactly that works. But if you were to run into the wall, the force that's stopping you isn't so much the matter of the electrons, the protons, and the neutrons, but it's really the strong nuclear force that's preventing you from running through that wall. But like we said, if you increase it, then I think, I don't know if I've got it up there. Yeah, if stronger, you would only have hydrogen. If it were any weaker, you would only have hydrogen. So it's very elementary for it. The weak nuclear force is also known as radiation. If it were stronger, it'd be insufficient for helium to generate heavy elements in the stars. For any weaker, the stars would burn out too quickly. Supernova explosions could not scatter heavy elements across the universe. So this is an example of a supernova. It's an extremely bright star that is exploding or dying. You could actually see it in the daylight if it were close enough to us. All right, principle of quantization. Proposed by Niels Bohr in 1910, without it, an electron would be sucked into the nucleus of the atom. This is what keeps the electrons in its particular orbit, its echelon. So I forget the term for that, but it's certain echelon or whatever. So this is just another example. Just remember, I'm covering these very broadly. The precision needed and the values needed for these are extremely, extremely small. All right, let's see. All right, some of the constants here. Let's look at gravity. This is Newton's description of gravity. The force of gravity, insert G, is the value of the distance, the radius squared of two masses. So the precision for this is just another example. And we'll get to an be able to compare this in a second. It's just another example here. So how fine-tuned is this? All right, let's look at a few of the other ones. Let's take that value that we just looked for gravity. And we'll just say, all right, the strong nuclear force, or the strength of the weak nuclear force is 10 to the 31 times stronger than the force of gravity. The strength of the electromagnetic force is 10 to the 37 times. And the strength of the strong nuclear force is 10 to the 47, or 10 to the 40 times stronger than the force of gravity. So if you were to write this out, it's 10,000 billion, 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 billion times the strength of gravity. So if I were to ask you which force is stronger, strong nuclear force or gravity, which would you say? Right, strong nuclear force. Even though gravity is very strong, it's what keeps the orbit of planets in position. It's what keeps the moon revolving around us. But you fight the whole force of the Earth's gravity every day when you walk or you sit up or you jump. You're going against the whole mass of the Earth. And so gravity is a very weak force when compared to the other ones. But it's very effective on the very large scale. So if I were to take a ruler, say I've got a ruler to compare this out. And this ruler stretches 15 billion light years into the distance. The strong nuclear force would be 15 billion light years away on this ruler, and the force of gravity would be 1 trillionth of an inch. That's how precisely fine-tuned gravity is when you look at all the other constants. Okay. I'm going to have a little bit of review of Einstein here for you. All right, that's Einstein's original field equation, with R being the set of, or the left-hand side of the equation being a description of the Ricci tensor, which is describes the spatial geometry of the universe. And the right hand side describes, this is, I wrote it on the board because it didn't show up on the iPad. On the right hand side describes the energy momentum of the universe. Now the term there, the lambda, this term was introduced by Einstein to suggest an eternal universe. It was such a small number when put on the left-hand side of the equation that it would suggest a flat and eternal universe. Now, when Einstein, this is back in 1915, 1917. Now, Edwin Hubble, he was, oh, I forget which observatory it was. Anyways, he took Einstein's equations along with a Belgian priest, Georges Lemaître, and they took Einstein's own equations and figured out that his math wasn't adding up to an eternal universe. And Edwin Hubble, on observation, noticed a redshift in some of the galaxies. When you have a redshift in light, it means that it's moving farther away, and so electromagnetic, or the light, gets redder as it moves further away, just like the Doppler effect of sound. And so it would suggest that there are galaxies that are moving away. If you extrapolate that and start pulling everything back in, it suggests that there had to be a finite beginning to it. And so Einstein looked at this equation and recognized that it was a clutch factor, and this is what he called his greatest blunder. But you can't just get rid of lambda. You just can't get rid of the term. And so what do? Well, you can move it over to the right-hand side of the equation, and instead of it describing the spatial geometry or the Ricci tensor, then it starts to describe the energy momentum. And so the way that we see the beginning of the universe playing out is that it went through an extremely rapid form of inflation. Inflation is, we need to discuss a few different models of the universe. We need, remind me if I don't get to, we need to discuss the static, oscillating, standard, and multiverse. Now, the standard model of inflationary cosmology is in the context that the universe began 13.723 billion years ago, and that the universe was a, this is like speaking of what was before the Big Bang, was a tiny ball of energy, so to speak. And it is in this inflationary field, usually called the string landscape. And try to picture a ball rolling down a hill. And then it gets into this bottom of the hill of a false vacuum. And this false vacuum is super cooling, and it allows the universe to inflate at a rapid expansion in the sense that it was, oh, I forget the measurements after a second. Or enough that if you were to take a balloon and you just start blowing up, the more you blow it up, the flatter it gets, right? So if you were to zoom in on it, it would seem flatter the closer you are. Like we're standing on Earth. The horizon looks pretty flat to us, but we know that the Earth is round. The universe expanded so much after just 1 second that it was almost completely flat. And so during this expansion is overcoming the force of gravity. Gravity can't pull itself back in. And so this term lambda is what, it's even within the last decade or so, a lot of cosmologists are calling it dark energies. It's something that's not detectable to our electromagnetic visibility, such as like dark matter. But this is dark energy, a repulsive force, almost like an anti-gravity. So what we're seeing now is that the universe is actually starting to expand faster. It rapidly expanded, kind of slowed down. It's pretty constant for 13 billion years or whatever. And then it's starting to expand even more. And the rate and the cosmological constant here, the term lambda, is arguably the most fine-tuned fine-tuned constant needed for life. Let's see. I don't know if I wrote it down anywhere. It cannot differ in one part out of minus 10 to the negative 55 centimeters squared. So this cannot vary at all within that degree in order for life, for the universe to expand at a rate that it does to permit the existence of life. And all this right now is in the context of an absolute beginning of the universe. We'll come back to that in a second, though. But that's an example of the cosmological constant. Actually, we're going to come back to this in a second, the Jordan-Rahn-Dickey theory. We'll talk about that. I just gave an example of arguing for the constants of nature. They're arbitrarily put into the beginning of the universe. The other physical laws or other constants have no causal impact or effect on what the other constants will be. So it seems rather arbitrary. But there's other versions of cosmology that would suggest that, all right, well, maybe there are other universes in which these constants vary. Okay, well, let's give an example. Varying speed of light attempts to solve the horizon problem. Real quick, the horizon problem is at that rapid point of expansion in the beginning, we know that light is the cosmic speed limit, so to speak. Although, has anybody heard of this neutrino issue going on? One of you? I promise. Alright. A couple weeks ago, actually 2 years ago, I think it was. Does anybody know what CERN is, or the LHC? Raise your hand if you've seen Angels and Demons. Maybe Angels and Demons. Alright, at the beginning of Angels and Demons, they're at CERN. It's this big a particle accelerator over in Switzerland and in France. And what they do is they smash particles together, try to get more particles. Like if you were to take a ball of Legos and throw it at another ball of Legos, you get not the ball, but you get the more fundamental parts. Break apart. But what CERN did is they shot a neutrino down to this OPERA, abbreviation, I forget what it is, this another accelerator in Italy, about 700 kilometers away or so. And the neutrino got there faster than the speed of light would. And so maybe we've got a case of either error, but they spent 2 years trying to account for the error, which was 60 nanoseconds they need to account for. And their error margin is only 6 or 7 nanoseconds. So maybe we've got a case where something can faster, or can travel faster than the speed of light. Or perhaps extra dimensions in the sense of, if you were to take a piece of paper and you make one line on one side, go to the other end of the paper and make another line, perhaps it's the case that a straight line isn't the quickest way there. You pull the piece of paper, you've got a shorter distance there. Maybe that's what happened with the neutrino. We don't know yet. But with this horizon problem, perhaps inflation expanded so quickly that light was not able to have any effect or propagation of information to other regions of the universe. So maybe the speed of light varies. That's very problematic. Because if you recall, Einstein's E equals mc squared. There's a term in there for the constant speed of light, and this is something that's been very faithful throughout physics. C, energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. If we were to change the speed of light, then that would change the amount of energy in the universe. You change the amount of energy in the universe, it would completely throw off the laws of thermodynamics. So it's not really an option to change the speed of light. But for all purposes, let's just say that we can deal with that for now. All right, the initial conditions of the universe. Roger Penrose, a very eminent cosmologist, calculates that the odds of the special low entropy condition having arisen by chance is the question mark. So what low entropy conditions represents is the way that the universe could be given its initial conditions. So there is a range of 10 to the 10 to 123. So you take the range of all possible universe, given that they're governed by the present laws, then you've got a landscape of 10 to the 500 possible universes. And with the fine-tuning of the cosmological constant, it shrinks down to 10 to 120. When comparatively, it is a very, very, very small number. All right. Now, step back from a little bit of science, let's go back to philosophy. Is God a legitimate scientific hypothesis? Does he belong in science? Well, maybe. All right, the best scientific evidence does actually suggest that the universe did have a very, very complex set of fine-tuning required for the existence of life. But, remember, we're not arguing for God, we're arguing just for some type of agency. But agency seems to be an acceptable form of explanation. The abductor reasoning, the inference is the best explanation, is actually the same reasoning Darwin used for evolution. His best explanation was natural selection acting on random mutation. I remember at the beginning of the class in Conan Spiegel, you read about Plantinga and his approach to doing science or philosophy. The Christian should use whatever revelation that he has in order to account for the data. Now, I tend to be a little more empirical. I prefer natural explanations over immaterial supernatural explanations because I have more experience with the natural world. That's the closest data that I can get, natural explanations. But sometimes I also have interactions empirically with other agents, with the existence of other minds like yourselves. So arguably, I would take the position that the existence of other minds and agencies are legitimate scientific hypotheses. So even though in the end we're going to put in this class all these arguments together and we're going to have a cumulative case for God, remember, with this argument alone, we're just arguing for some type of agency. All right, the multiverse. This is my favorite. I've been waiting all semester for this thing. So what do we do with other universes? Now, this is going to sound very sci-fi, but try to give it a little bit of credence here. So this is the biggest move in cosmology in the last few decades. This is one of the forms of the models that Stephen Hawking promotes. It's a very, very popular model of cosmology. A lot of times it's an attempt to escape the fine-tuning problem. A lot of, say, atheist cosmologists will say, all right, it is the case that this universe is extremely fine-tuned. But what if there's a lottery of universes to be selected from? If you increase the number of trials, we're bound to get it. So if there's an infinite set of other universes, then the probability of life existing is exactly one. Life must exist. If the probability is one, it has to exist. And so what do we do with this? Is there an infinite set of universes? What do we do with that? And so that's what we're going to do here. Also, you have a twin somewhere, I don't know. We'll kind of work through that out. But clarifying my terms here. When I say universe, I'm referring to what we would call our Hubble volume, what we observe, our local system. By multiverse, it's the aggregate of other universes. Like, so look at these bubbles, like just one would be our universe, the multiverse would refer to the whole one. So let's kind of go ahead and look at a few examples of this, and feel free to ask questions or whatever, I'm just talking away. So, all right, there's four versions of the multiverse. Level one multiverse, this is actually pretty uncontroversial, but also a bit of a misnomer. The level one multiverse just merely suggests that there's more regions beyond what we observe. Not that big of a deal. It's one system, one Hubble volume. It's just that there is more space than what we see. There's a lot of metaphysical stuff that some cosmologists. This is Max Tegmark's versions of the multiverse. There's other people who advocate like five different versions. I think Tegmark's is the best. So space is infinite. That's the only. We'll talk about infinity in a second, but that's the biggest claim to it. All right, level two multiverse. This is typically what you hear when you think of multiverse. If you were to think of the universe, if you've ever watched a pot of water boil, if you were ever that bored, and you watch a pot of water boil, you'll start noticing at the bottom that the bubbles appear and start rising to the top. Now, turn that into like a bathtub full of like bubble bath. That's what the universe would look like. It's just with the bubbles being the universes, that's what it would look like. Same fundamental equations of physics. This is the most popular version of the multiverse. Just that there are other systems out there, but there is no way that we could be able to gain access to those universes.
All right.
But here's an example of physical evidence. A lot of people would say, all right, this is not science. The multiverse is purely a philosophical claim. It's non-scientific. I would argue that it is actually a scientific claim. There is a lot of philosophy involved in it, but it is a scientific claim. We've all seen the WMAP data here, the cosmic microwave background radiation. Take a telescope. Now, remember, speaking of creationism here. We take a telescope and we look in the far distance of the universe. We'll see other planets. We'll see other galaxies. We'll see the neighborhood of other galaxies. And then you look far enough, you'll see this color, this sphere of red and blue and green that surrounds us. What this is, according to these calculations, 300,000 years after the Big Bang, when photons were able to be produced, to evolve, so to speak. And so you look at this, and you put certain thermal recognition or algorithms or equations to try to get certain thermal patterns, and you get these, this paper where I pulled this out of, actually called them, the technical term is a blob. These blobs, and they suggest that perhaps it's the case that these bubbles collided with each other at the very early stages of the development of the universe. Maybe that's the case. The Planck satellite, which is the one over here on the right, that's the data after its 1-year survey. Its 7-year survey should come out in 4 more years, I think. And this paper that suggested this, they were very modest. And they said, look, we need more data on this. We've got a good trace of this, but we need Planck to clarify this for us. So it's very exciting. There are empirical ways of verifying this. You can also verify it at CERN, which would actually confirm our next level of the multiverse,
level 3, which is actually quite controversial.
In this version of the multiverse, it depends on your interpretation of quantum mechanics. Remember, quantum mechanics is how particles behave on the very small level. And there's 10 or 12, we'll look at them in a second, interpretations of the data. This one is the many worlds interpretation. So here's an example of how things work. We've got a man and a woman. Hey, would you like to go out for a drink? One scenario that says, oh, sorry, I'm too tired, and they go home and they go their separate ways. There's another circumstance in which she says, oh, sure, why not? They get married and they have kids. Now, that's, of course, on a macro scale. But what happens with this version is that everything that can happen does happen, or it's a sum over histories. The way that particles work is that they'll typically travel like this. And say there's an observer right here, and everything that happens happens quite randomly. But things don't actually happen until we observe them, which is really, really weird. And so this is what's called the wave collapse of sort of quantum futures. And so perhaps it's the case that we don't actually have one circumstance or one instance of a particle going a certain way. Perhaps every possible quantum interaction actually does happen. This is, it sounds like somebody took possible worlds and took it way too far. That's what this would suggest. And a way of verifying this is at CERN, if we take the particles and we accelerate them and we crash them together and we get less information back from what we started with, then that would indicate that perhaps some of that information was propagated into another dimension. I know this sounds really weird, but bear with me. Does anybody have any questions so far? Is anybody just completely lost? Yeah, Adam.
Yeah, would it be wrong to say that, like, this is kind of like separate realities? That'd be wrong. Like, that'd be a wrong statement.
No, that would be completely accurate.
And so what's very controversial about it is that at every quantum interaction, another me is propagated. Although it wouldn't be identical, it'd be similar. But
never mind.
Oh, okay. All right, any other questions before we move on? Yeah.
I think that our book argues that there aren't any other, or that there isn't sufficient evidence for other universes in denying that the argument that this probability could, like, if there is one universe like this because of all the many, the infinite number of universes in the world. Like, what, like, why does it say that there isn't any evidence for it?
A lot of this evidence is, like, that you're hearing now is very recent. Papers from, we're going to look at a paper in a second that just came out last year. And it was very controversial in the sense of, like, we don't have a lot of empirical evidence for it. Just like we've got a lot of empirical evidence for, say, standard Big Bang models or whatever. But it's very controversial. Dr. Beck actually wrote a chapter in a book that mentioned this about fine-tuning, and he just kind of said, all right, we don't have much evidence for it. Gambler's fallacy, we'll talk about in a second. It's just not very popular in a lot of the older material, but it's gaining a lot of popularity.
How would you go about proving this? Like, are people trying to make a DeLorean and go throughout the multiverse? Like,
well,
it's just theory?
A lot of it is mathematics. It's a debate whether it's science, whether it's math, or whether it's philosophy. But, I mean, if we've got empirical data like this that could suggest that the brains or the bubbles collided with other ones, then that could be good evidence for, say, a level 2 multiverse. And it's also given the way that inflation works in the landscape of vacuums and so on and so forth. Those are just some implications. But that's where it would seem kind of unscientific. We can't just test that field theory. That's just purely mathematics. But with the accelerator, if we have less information than what we started with, then that information has to be counted somewhere, and this would explain that. So it's still trying to be developed where it can be verified and falsified. Yeah?
What about Edwin Abbott, Flatland? Have you read that?
No. Yeah, it's quite interesting. The early church father, Origen, however you want to pronounce that G, he actually wrote on circumstances of which there's basically other us's and other worlds and stuff. It is quite interesting. And William Paley actually touches on this. He's like, if you find many watches, then you've got even more awe for the designer and so on and so forth. So philosophically and theologically, it's been dealt with. But now we're actually facing some of scientific data. All right. We kind of talked about this a little bit
with quantum mechanics and logic and everything. This is just an example of that double slit experiment. Keep going from that. Level 4 multiverse. This is the end all. This is covering everything else. It's actually quite platonic. Mathematical existence equals physical existence. This would provide a lot of good answers to why these equations, not others, because any type of mathematical existence is identical to physical existence. Now, let's see. All right, how many universes are there? A lot of proponents would suggest that there are an infinite set of universes. We need to talk about infinity for a second. There's a difference between an actual infinite and a potential infinite. I don't know if you can see that, but that's the Hebrew letter Aleph. It's like a little N, and it's a little zero. So it's pronounced Aleph null or Aleph not. It represents an actual infinite. So if we were to take the drinking song, 99 bottles of beer on the wall, taking down past ground, we've got 98 bottles of beer on the wall. So if you were to take Aleph null number of bottled beers on the wall, take them down, pass around, you still have Aleph null bottles of beer. And so it represents an actual infinite. And the sideways lazy eight, the technical term for that is a lemniscate, that represents a potential infinite. I would argue that an actual infinite is impossible. It's just a concept. Whereas a potential infinite is potential. So to give an illustration, the famous illustration of Hilbert's hotel. Hilbert has a hotel with an infinite set of rooms. And say there's a philosophy convention, and we all go to this convention, and we have an infinite number of philosophers coming. He's like, sure, I've got room, let's put you into the rooms. So if we have an infinite set of rooms, how many rooms have been filled? All of them have been filled. And so say the second day comes around, a lot of philosophers, let's say half of the philosophers give their presentation. And those philosophers were in every odd-numbered room, 1, 3, 5, so on and so forth. So they all leave, and then everybody shifts back down. How many philosophers do we have left? We still have an infinite number of philosophers. So you can take identical quantities and subtract them by identical quantities and still get the same number. Now, there's rules for transfinite math where you can use infinites and so on and so forth. But in the actual world, an infinite cannot exist. It's just absurd. You come to contradictions. You can subtract infinite minus 3 and still get an infinite number. So philosophically and mathematically, it's really hard to get to an infinite in the physical reality. But that question mark number that didn't show up. So, given inflationary cosmology, it's suggested that there are 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 7 number of universes out there. It's an extremely large number. Now remember, if we were to, let's look at 10 to the 8. If 10 to the 8 is an accurate number of the number of elementary particles in our universe, if I were to write 1 and then put a 0 on every particle in this universe, that's what it would take to write out that number. Now compare it with this number. It's got 3 exponents, it's a huge number. But what's really important to know about this number is that it's finite. This was a paper published by Andre Linda. In that paper, I've got it up there for you. Who suggests that the way that slow roll inflation works, remember, picture a ball rolling down a hill into a pulse back. The way that it works is that it would only propagate a certain finite number of universes. Also, what's called the Borde-Vilenkin-Guth theorem, BVG, suggests that just given the state of gravity, if any universe has, on average, an expansion greater than 1, which basically means that it's expanding, there has to be an absolute beginning. And so this
This is another form of the cosmological argument. And so it would apply to the beginning of the multiverse as well. If a multiverse exists and it had an absolute beginning, and these constants and whatever were packed in there. All right, so that's fine-tuning with the beginning. Now we got to look at the oscillating model of the universe. This one, I think, just hands over the argument to us. Well, we'll get repetitive design or whatever. So say that we've got this scale right here. We got the x-axis being time, and then spatial geometry. And so say that the universe expands, comes back, expands, comes back, expands. It's crunching back in on itself, expanding. It just keeps bouncing back and forth on and for eternity. All right, so what do we do with this? If there's no beginning and the universe just keeps going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, what do we do? I think this really just gives us the argument. Because what you would need is a causal or concurrent fine-tuning along the way. So you would need present, there's no initial conditions to the universe. The fine-tuner would have to be fine-tuning it along the way. And so it's a causal or concurrent. There's no initial conditions that are put in. So it's basically handing us the argument. And then there's the static model of the universe, that one which was the most popular until the 1920s, before Hubble and Einstein and everything. Everybody thought the universe was just a brute fact. It just existed for eternity. Well, it's kind of along the same lines of the oscillating model. There's no initial conditions put in, and so the values that we would have to be concurrent or acausally applied to the universe. So if you want to say the universe is eternal, then sure, you give me the argument. If you want to say it's oscillating, then you give me the argument. If you want to say multiverse, as we're going to get to in a second, I'm going to say you just give me the argument again. We actually advocate that the multiverse actually makes the fine-tuning argument a lot stronger. And I think it's got a lot of great theological attraction to it. All right, any questions about this so far? We've got 20 minutes. Doing good. Okay. Here are 13 examples of quantum
mechanics, the ensemble of Copenhagen. But Copenhagen is your general standard model, the one that most people adhere to. Royal, Bohm, many worlds, many minds.
I am really familiar with transactional, Copenhagen, and many worlds. Those are the only ones that I'm familiar with. Ask me about the other ones, don't know. But those are your options. Okay.
Going back to the multiverse. This is how I'm going to advocate that the multiverse actually makes the fine-tuning argument much stronger. So the way that I do that is that the mechanisms needed for the multiverse to function themselves have to be fine-tuned. If we were just to say that if we were to increase the odds of getting a lucky universe of which life exists, then that's really just the gambler's fallacy. So say that I've got, say that I'm playing roulette and there's like 40 spots on there or whatever. And so I've got 1 in 40 possibility of getting one of those numbers. And if I increase the number of roulette spinners or tables, that doesn't increase the odds of me, say, landing on number 14. So the more that you increase doesn't change any prior probabilities. It has no effect on that. Now, if you take, say I've got a set of 10, and this roulette table has 10 spots on it, and I'm trying to get on number 5. I spin the first one, it lands on 6. Well, that doesn't mean that my next option removes number 6 from that spot. So that would be the gambler's fallacy. Does anybody have any questions about that one? Gambler's fallacy is trying to suggest that prior probabilities have an effect on the outcome after successive tries.
All right, some of you are zoning. I'm sorry. Hopefully I'm keeping your attention somewhat. Okay, so there's four things needed for this to work. First one, the inflation field that we spoke of. A mechanism to supply the energy needed to expand the bubble. That would be the fine-tuning of the actual field, or the landscape. Number two, a mechanism to form the bubbles.
this would be Einstein's field equation. Now remember, the lambda now is on the right-hand side of the equation, plus the inflation field. So those two have to be extremely fine-tuned in order for the multiverse to work. Three, a mechanism to convert energy of inflation field to the normal mass energy we find in our universe. Basically, just the way that everything plays itself out. This mechanism, our understanding of energy, coupled between the inflation field and matter fields. And number four, the fourth element that needs to be extremely fine-tuned, is a mechanism that allows enough variation in the constants of physics. So if we want to say that light or the cosmological constant, let's say that they vary, okay, well, we need a mechanism that allows these variations to exist. And that could be string or super string theory or string theory. String theory, anybody heard of string theory? All right, so that's, what's that?
I read comics, so.
Oh, okay, I didn't know about that. I'll actually send out links. There's actually this, if you've ever seen Nova specials on PBS, they've actually got a really good one on string theory. So this is what a string would look like. There's one end, and then it's really a one-dimensional string. And this is just to say that this is the most fundamental aspect of our universe. The universe is composed of tiny vibrating strings. To give a scale of how big these strings are, if the atom were the size of a galaxy, the string would be the size of a tree. So it's very, very small. Debatable as whether they're open or whether they're closed circles, but the way that they vibrate and resonate depends on what particle they would form. And so that would be string theory. Super string theory is to suggest that there's a supersymmetry, there's for every particle, there's an antiparticle to it. So that would allow for the variation. So itself would need to be fine-tuned. And so a lot of people who would appeal to the multiverse to try to get out of the fine-tuning argument is what's called information displacement. You're pushing back the information back another step, which doesn't do anything to solve the problem. You're just pushing it back a step. We just go back to that next step, and we solve it again, or we provide an explanation. All right. Is the multiverse compatible with theism? I would argue yes. This is a very controversial position, but it is, I believe, to be compatible. Let's look at the history of cosmology here, the history of science. This is, I know it's really hard to see, but this is the Aristotelian or Ptolemaic model of the universe. That was a geocentric solar system, and our galaxy was all that existed. Remember, Kant viewed the Andromeda galaxy, and he was like, oh, well, it's an island universe. There was a point in time, not too long ago, within the last two centuries, that we thought that the universe was just our galaxy, was just our locality in space. And now, the more that our technology increases, the more that we can see, all right, well, there's a little bit more. This is the Hubble Deep Field. I know it's really hard to see, but each one of those little dots is a different galaxy. And so our understanding of the universe is becoming completely more comprehensive. And so it has precedent. It's not like this is a huge step from where the trend has been going. Also, let's say that this fine-tuner is God. Let's say for right now that this is God. The multiverse is an open system. Even in the naturalistic sense, the multiverse is an open system. Other cause and effects can propagate from one system to another. And so if we were to say that, if we were to start off with the notion of God, our understanding of God, if we were to ask the question, what would God create, we would expect to have an open system. And arguably, part of the theological attraction to the multiverse, I think it's aesthetically, I think it's very, it's such a beautiful concept. It expresses the infinite creativity of God. And so, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, we should all be familiar with Leibniz or have heard of him. He had this principle called the principle of plentitude. Dr. Beck likes to call it the principle of platypus, because it suggests that the more things that exist, or the variety of things that exist, represent an aspect of God in his infinite creativity. Thomas Aquinas said something familiar about something similar to this, in the sense that God expresses himself through things that exist via his essence. And so if there's possibly or potentially an infinite range of variety and the existence of things, then that would be God displaying his glory and so on and so forth. So I think there's a very attractive component to this idea, theologically speaking. All right, weak anthropic principle. The universe we inhabit must have a life-permitting structure that appears enough to make the observer relative. So basically what this says is that we should not be surprised to see a universe that is life-friendly, simply because if we weren't here to observe it, then it wouldn't be happening. Now, we need to be careful with this. There is some good aspects of the anthropic principle, and there are some abuses of it. Ultimately, it can lead to a tautology, meaning that it's true all the way down, because if you always have an observer in that universe that is life-friendly, then it's always going to happen. But as opposed to the strong anthropic principle, life had to exist. Not many people take that position. But there is a certain element to this. There are many people who would suggest that the laws of physics have changed in this universe. I think the anthropic principle is a great example of how we can verify or falsify that claim. If we look out into the distance and we see that physics of stars and everything are behaving differently, then we can suggest that the physics at one time were different. But we're not seeing that. We're seeing an isotropic and homogeneous universe, which means that everything is the same or behaves the same. And so if we take that out, even within our system, then we've got a really faulty understanding of the universe if that changes. So that's a good application of the anthropic principle. All right. Somebody want to read this for me? That's okay. All right. This is, if you were to write the universe out mathematically, this is what the universe would look like. This is the standard model of particle physics, the standard model of the Big Bang. And this is just more for
the sake of you just getting to know it. But there's a term in here that's very controversial. Can anybody spot which term it is? Take a guess. No, lambda. Lambda's good. All right, it's right there, in case you didn't see it. Whoops. It's the H.
It's what's called the Higgs boson. It's also, this might strike a bell, the God particle. Have you ever heard of that? God particle is what gives particles mass. And so this is the leading edge of physics. This is where we're going.
If we find the Higgs boson, then we come closer to having a complete model of the universe. We haven't found it yet. That's the H term. That's what it would look like. Just a side note, it's pretty interesting. All right.
Is this model descriptive of creation?
Maybe. Again, I'll let you go back to your creation studies class to work out how you fit it all together, but I'm just focusing on the science aspect of it. Let me read to you this excerpt from this cosmologist, or this physicist, Brian Cox. This is what he has to say about it. We know the universe began 13.7 billion years ago in an immensely hot, dense state much smaller than a single atom. It began to expand about a million billion billion billionth of a second after the Big Bang. gravity separated away from other forces, the universe then underwent an exponential expansion called inflation. In about the first billionth of a second or so, the Higgs field kicked in, and the quarks, gluons, and electrons that make up got mass. The universe continued to expand and cool, and after a few minutes, there was hydrogen and helium in the universe. That's all. The universe was about 75% hydrogen, 25% helium. It still is today. It continued to expand about 300 million years. Then light was big enough to travel through the universe. It was big enough to be transparent to light, and that's what we see in the cosmic microwave background. After about 400 million years, the first stars formed, and that hydrogen and that helium then began to cook into heavier elements. Stars were cooked up, exploded, then recollapsed into other generations of stars and planets. And on some of those planets, in the first generation of stars, could fuse hydrogen to form water, liquid water, on the surface. The laws of physics, the right laws of physics, they're beautifully balanced. They could have been different. If the weak force were different, then carbon and oxygen wouldn't be stable in the hearts of stars, and there would be none of that in the universe. And I think that's a wonderful and significant story. This is coming from an atheist describing how this model looks. George Smoot, I think his name's George, but he won not too long ago
the Nobel Prize in Physics for that microwave background radiation. And he says it's like looking back at the face of God.
All right, we've got 5 minutes here. All right, this is an obvious problem.
What do we do with natural evil? With earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis? If there's a fine tuner and the result of these physics and this fine tuning results in natural disasters like earthquakes,
then what do we do? This is about as good as that argument gets us. If you can't read it, it says, I'm ironing a kitten, therefore your argument is invalid. That's about what this argument, or the objection from natural evil does. It's a red herring. It's a big red fish meant to distract you from the real issue. So, actually, for the example of earthquakes, we need earthquakes in order to survive. Earthquakes are a result of the liquid iron, et cetera, moving around the core of the Earth, and that results in tectonic shift. We need tectonic shift in order for that to be present. But the reason why we need that iron core to be moving around in the center is because it creates the magnetic field around the Earth. With that magnetic field around the Earth, that prohibits a lot of solar radiation from getting into our atmosphere. And if we didn't have that magnetic field to protect us from that solar radiation, we would die. So that's just an example of that. All right. Fred Hoyle, this guy right here, he's actually a staunch, I don't know if he's still alive, but he was a very staunch proponent of the static model of the universe, the eternal steady state model. He says, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, and that there are no blind forces in nature. In conclusion, that the only way that we can sufficiently account for this data, or an inference to the best explanation, is that there is a fine tuner. Natural evil doesn't matter. It can be a completely evil fine tuner for all I care. It says nothing about the moral quality. Now, we'll get to the moral argument next class, but that argues for moral quality. Now, real quick. Richard Dawkins' famous explanation, or he's running around like he's got the solution for it. Well, this argument doesn't work because you need it. Who designed the designer? We talked about this. You don't need an explanation of the explanation in order for the explanation to be the best explanation. So, in order for me to explain where this chair came from, I don't need to be able to explain the factory. Well, in order to explain the factory, I don't need to explain the design plan and the architecture behind it. So,
the existence of a disembodied mind who either, depending on the model, if it's eternal, okay, if it's oscillating, okay, that's concurrent or acausal information propagation. If there is a beginning, whether or not it's the multiverse or Big Bang or 10,000 years ago, there is an initial conditions of information that is precisely fine-tuned for the existence of life. And that will get us to a fine-tune. So if you've got any questions, come see me afterwards.